Welcome to Books in the Freezer, a podcast dedicated to the deliciously disturbing world of horror fiction. I'm your host, Stephanie, and today I am joined by author Jennifer Thorne to talk about her latest novel, Diavola, and the horror that comes with vacationing. Welcome to the show. Did I pronounce that right, too? It is Diavola.
You did.
Right?
That was brilliant. Yeah. And I mean, I'm like not an expert in Italian. If anybody who's read this book will know, I'm a big fan of Duolingo. So that's my Duolingo level of Italian, which is not that great, but gets me by.
Yeah. My husband and I went to Paris a few months ago for our anniversary, and I was on Duolingo, like trying to learn French, and I don't feel like it helped me at all. I think like the sentences they give you. And French is a difficult language.
Well, and the sentences are niche. Like,
yeah.
Like, and it's funny, you get these like kind of eerie things on there. Like, my aunt was in a terrible train accident. And you're like, oh God, I hope I never have to say that in French or any language. But
yeah, I can't wait to try that on my waiter, you know?
Yeah, the useful French. Although I did find that like in school too.
Yeah.
We would study like 19th century French literature, so I could describe, you know, the particular petticoat in French that like a character wore, but I didn't know what anything was on a menu. I still don't. I've finally gotten over myself enough when I'm traveling to be like, I don't know what this means. Like, lay it out to me. Draw me a picture.
Yeah. There it is. Yeah. I remember that in high school too. Like our textbooks had just sentences. I'm like, and when I am in Germany, do you think I'm going to ask someone how many times they feed their cat?
I don't know, that could be useful if you're like house sitting.
That's true, I guess.
It's a very specific circumstance, but
all right, well, do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about Diavola?
So Diavola is about the Pace family, a kind of upper middle class American family that with adult kids and grandkids that every year has a big family vacation to some lovely venue. And this year they've gone and to Tuscany, and they've gotten a lovely Airbnb villa outside of this remote village called Monteperso. And they picked the wrong villa, basically. It's really nice. It's got a pool. It's got views everywhere. And it's also just super haunted. And it probably wouldn't have been a great vacation anyway, because they just don't get along that well. In particular, our protagonist, Anna, is kind of the scapegoat for the family for really no good reason, except that they just don't completely get her. And then they kind of pick on her about that. And they kind of try to passive aggressively hack away at the aspects of her personality that they don't approve of or they don't understand. But she's a pretty stoic person. She's got a really strong sense of herself. So she weathers these vacations every year. And you know, it's worth it to go to a lovely place and get to travel and actually kind of check that box of I am still connected with my family. I'm doing the right thing. I'm a good person. But this year's different. There's a lot of ghosts in this place, and one of them is extremely malevolent and parasitic. And that's what Diavola is about.
My God, I loved this. I am a big sucker for dysfunctional families in any genre, but I mean, the horror of it pairs so well, but it was so frustrating as a reader to read this from Anna's perspective and just see this very realistic dynamics between the family with like people enabling this type of behavior and the way that they just pick on her and turn things around on her and just always make things her fault. You're just like,
the expectation, like, first of all, that set up that she should translate everything for them, that she's in some way, you know, that they're entitled to her knowledge set because they've paid for this vacation, when her Italian's not really that good. And she knows it isn't that good. She's like, I just did Duolingo, but like, you could use an app, but okay.
Yeah.
And that sort of sets it off right away, sort of that they lean on her and then push her away at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I think it's interesting seeing people's responses to the book, because some people are like, oh, thank God my family is not like this. And some people are like, oh, there's definitely some relatable bits, just amplified, which is kind of where I sit. And then some people are like, this was really upsetting for me because this is exactly what my family is like. And I think, oh God, that's terrible. I'm very sorry. But, you know, any group of people traveling together, there are going to be points where you get on each other's nerves, and the parts of your personality that grate kind of get amplified by being stuck in a house together, miles away from what you're used to and your sort of everyday comforts, and having to negotiate the, you know, what do we do today? How do we maximize? And everybody coming in with their own ideas of what the perfect, you know, Florence holiday is. I mean, and I'm kind of vicious with the characters, but, in some, and, you know, I think that the assumption for a lot of people will be that I'm picking on my own family, but I'm really not. A lot of, most of the Pace family has an exaggerated version of something that I do on vacation. So for example, Nicole coming in with her detailed itinerary and expecting everything to revolve around her children because she's the one mother in the group. I have definitely been guilty of that before, and my family kind of mocked me for it. So I had to put it in the book.
So putting it from the other perspective.
Yeah.
And I think that the fact that Anna has a sense of humor, I mean, you see where she's had to develop that with those kind of family dynamics.
Yes.
But makes it fun to be in her perspective when it's not a fun situation to be in. But yeah, like everything getting so amplified just with the idea, just with the circumstances that come with traveling and when you accidentally pick a haunted Airbnb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes it worse, I would think. But there's always something, you know, travel, we have this expectation of, you know, this, you know, Instagram kind of travel, the image of it, you know, the picture somebody takes, and you just sort of you spool that out in your mind into this perfect 2 weeks or however long it is. But travel can be incredibly annoying. And you just kind of blur that part of your memory.
Yeah.
You know, the airport and the plane ride. I mean, I actually love flying, especially when I'm doing solo travel, but halfway through, you know, you're like, okay, I'm ready for this to be over.
Yeah.
And you know, your luggage gets lost and you don't speak the language, and there's just this constant sort of discomfort of being foreign and this not being your usual circumstances. And if you have really high expectations for how you think this is supposed to go, it's almost worse because you have this cognitive dissonance of, I need a perfect holiday. You know, I've been really looking forward to this, and it creates this inability to go with the flow that can be really, really stressful. And I think it's like, and then, you know, depending on who you're with, travel can, you know, break up friendships. You know, you have a friend at home that you love each other. You get along great. And then you go and on a trip together and you never want to speak to the person again because you see different aspects of their personality come out, like how rude they are to the waiters, you know, how they criticize the culture to their face, or even if it's not anything that damning, just that you just cannot decide, you cannot communicate or negotiate what to do with your trip. And it just builds up tensions between you.
Which leads nicely into my next question. What is it about vacations and horror that makes them a great pairing?
It is that like kind of disorientation. I mean, you're out of the usual, you're out of your comfort zone. You really, really want it to be great. And the only thing you've really taken with you because you've left your house behind is yourself. And so you start to see reflections of yourself in how different you are from the things around you. I mean, the more different the culture, the more kind of striking this probably is. And so you have to confront yourself in a certain way. And the, you know, the feeling of being the other, if you're not used to that, can be really, really unsettling. And then also, travel is a circumstance in which lots of things are primed to go wrong because of the sort of logistics of it, in exactly the circumstances where it's really hard to recover from the things going wrong because you don't speak the language or you don't understand the culture, you don't know what the road signs mean. And so it's easy to spool that out into something from lots of little things going wrong to something going very, very, very wrong.
And yeah, as a tourist, you're not privy to the local knowledge. Like when all the locals say, you know, we don't go up to that place up on the hill. You as the outsider don't know why. You're not. You don't have this knowledge.
That. Yeah. Yeah. Like, well, I will. Why not?
Do-do-do-do-do.
I love traveling. I love traveling. It's like one of my favorite things in the world. But I have nightmares almost weekly and have for years and years about traveling. And usually I'm in some either a city or a small town or a small village, Eastern Europe, somewhere kind of vaguely, I don't speak the language at all. And I haven't booked accommodations and it's nighttime and the streets are desolate and I have to figure it out. And then sometimes there's vampires. Sometimes there's just absolutely nobody in this town. Sometimes it's like, I don't know if you ever have those dreams where you're in a hotel and you go up the elevator and the floor's not finished. No. And you're just walking around a building site. Totally normal, right?
I'll start having these nightmares now, though. Yes, now that that's been introduced as a scenario.
It's obviously a preoccupation of mine. Like travel as kind of a symbol of, and I think it started when I got pregnant with my first child. So I have analyzed it, and I think it has something to do with this feeling of not knowing where I'm going, not knowing exactly what's going to happen next, and feeling out of control with that. So I think everybody has that feeling to some extent. So travel as a theme amplifies all those feelings of being out of control.
Yeah. And also, I mean, within horror, the types of places you're staying in, I feel like I've seen a new crop of horror that's like Airbnb rental.
Yeah.
Horror. But, we're like,
yeah, it's somebody's space and you're invading it. And there's that question of like, why is somebody letting me live in their house? That's weird. And we've all just accepted that it's okay and it's nice and fine.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's not going to be.
It is just odd. We had to stay in an Airbnb for a week while we were waiting to move into our house because like the date that we like sold our house and the day we were moving in just like did not line up. We stayed in an Airbnb in Pittsburgh, and it was definitely someone's just like primary residence. You know, there was just like family pictures and like wedding pictures on the wall and just like a normal kitchen and like bedrooms. And I'm just like, this just feels odd.
Yeah. Like you've had amnesia, and waking up in a place like that is like, where am I?
I'm just like, where are they? Yeah. It's also, it's a genre I really like in movies.
It's in more movies, I feel like, than books.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I know I saw the Rental with, how did I forget her name? She's married to David Franco.
Allison Brie.
Allison Brie. I'm like, Annie, you know, Annie from, awesome. I did not know that.
Yeah.
I was going to say Annie from Community. I'm like, you know who I'm talking about. Like that Airbnb, you and your group of friends don't know this house, don't know if there's like cameras anywhere. You can't like get a hold of the person.
Yeah, that freaked me out. And I'll go places. Like I'll do like writing retreats at Airbnbs and I'm like looking around for the camera. Like I'm qualified. Find a hidden camera. Like I've had CIA training or something. But it freaked me out for sure.
Start Googling like, which is the like two-way mirror one? Is it like if there's a space or if your fingers touch? Like I get all confused.
I'm not gonna like unscrew the light bulbs.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't know. Who am I? But there was I also think of, I mean, they're not my favorite type of movies, but the hostel movies, especially the first one, is, you know, like annoying Americans abroad and mm-hmm. you see them pay a price for being essentially annoying Americans abroad.
Yeah, I mean, that is the sort of positive, I mean,
positive, okay. I mean,
that's a positive spin on it. My husband actually like hates those movies because he thinks of them as this American perspective of like, never leave America.
Or oh, it definitely is.
Especially if you're a woman, this at least changes it to being young men that, you know, get led into being seduced into torture porn instead of actual porn, which is what they'd hoped for.
Yeah.
But like the Taken movies, you know, if you could sort of combine those, it's like you're, Eastern Europe, you're definitely going to get kidnapped by secret societies. And he finds that offensive because he's British. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. I despise the Taken movies. I don't know why. Like, that is like a film franchise I despise.
Well, I mean, that was the first one. And then the second one was like, what, again?
It just, I mean, that's just happening.
Carelessness. Come on. At this point, you're on your own, dude.
Yeah.
Like, and he's like increasingly getting older and falling apart. And you just want to be like, put your feet up, man. You've earned this. Just stop.
Why does everyone keep getting taken? Yeah.
I mean, taken again. There is that fear, though, isn't there? Of like, you go outside your comfort zone and you're just so wide-eyed and naive and excited to travel. And you're definitely going to be like taken advantage of and drugged and kidnapped and tortured.
It's funny because it is the setup for honestly so much horror, because even like a cabin in the woods, it's like, yeah, you're there on vacation. You are there like on a trip with your friends and you're being stalked from some like outside force, which is such a horror staple, and it's vacation horror.
What's so great? I mean, there's so many great things about Cabin in the Woods. I really love that movie, but what's great about it is like you start off the movie and you're like, wow, these idiots, don't they know that they're driving into a horror movie? They're such cliches. But honestly, if somebody was like, oh, I'm going to rent this cabin. It's like really nice. You know, there's hikes. I'd be like, yeah, that sounds amazing. I would definitely go.
Yeah.
I would be the cliche.
Your characters don't know the genre of movie they're in.
Yeah, and yeah, they could have wandered into all sorts of circumstances given the ending of that movie, but yeah, that's movie's so good. I love that. And I love that the, like, kind of refusal to be that cliche, to be like, no, I'm a human being and you can't reduce me to like the virgin ends the world.
Yeah.
You should have just gone with it. I don't know if that's the takeaway, that they should have died, but it kind of was for me.
I don't know. It does seem selfish to just, like, out of stubbornness, like, kill absolutely everyone.
I don't think they knew it was... I think they didn't believe it.
And then
just gave away the ending.
Sorry.
Everybody's seen this movie, right?
But yeah, then there's also another, like, Americans traveling abroad. You have Midsommar.
I love that movie so much. I watched that after I wrote my first horror, Loot. And I
really?
It's really, and which is a folk horror in a, like an isolated British or European community, in this case it's British. And the similarity there is that you're sort of left with the feeling at the end that in some ways this is good. This community is actually good for the protagonist, and you can understand why in the end she chooses it, because it's actually really healing for her in a way that staying home would not have been. Again, I'm not sure if that's the right takeaway, but that was mine, that like, this was what she needed after the horrible things she'd been through. It was like cathartic. She needed to be absolutely subsumed by another culture. This is different from Loot, by the way, but the horror of that, like, especially initially, is this, you know, like, oh, what a quaint little quirk of their culture. I'm going to go along for the ride. Because to speak up and be like, this is weird, is incredibly rude. And you have that ingrained in yourself. Like, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. Don't be obnoxious. So they just like really ignore these gut feelings of this is wrong and we need to get out of here and this is weird. Especially since their friend brought them. I mean, that was really the way that.
Yeah, that it's like his.
It's culture. The okay. It's the check of safety.
Yeah. I mean, the horror community is very divided on interpretations of that film, so you're definitely not alone on the takeaways for that.
Yeah. And she just wasn't, I mean, she wasn't able, after what had happened to her, she wasn't able to cope as an individual. I mean, she, that scene with the sort of sisterhood around her screaming, how like healing that was for her. But of course she's like, she sort of ceases to be a person at the end. Yeah. She's just another ant in that hive. And that's scary in a certain way, but that's probably what she wanted and needed. She couldn't be herself anymore. She was not going to survive it. So that in that way, travel, she needed to travel from her horrible home circumstance in order to completely kind of detach from what her idea of what a life was, and in order to survive in someplace else. And I guess that's kind of the case with Diavola too. It's similar to Diavola in that she needed to travel someplace and have this sort of horrendous experience happen to her in order to redefine what a life is and cut ties with all the things that were toxic in her life. But I think that's where the similarities probably end, but in a way it's a positive thing for them to go off, face trauma, and then come out the other side of it.
Definitely. I can see those similarities. Oh, I also thought of I Still Know What You Did Last Summer. I just love that fun era of slasher movies. And there's so much about that movie that is just dumb.
It's so dumb. I know.
The villain reveal.
Oh my gosh. And it should have been, I mean, I know this has been much discussed, but it should have been I Still Know What You Did the Summer Before Last at that point.
That's true.
But there was I was leaning so hard on like this sort of Scream level of like twists and things without actually being clever. But it is just delightful. It's delightful in the same way as like the Five Nights at Freddy's movie. Where if that movie had been any good, it wouldn't have been any good. But because it was so bad, it was amazing. That's one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. But yeah, really? I love the like horrible things are happening and continuing to happen. But let's just go to the Bahamas because we won something on the radio.
Yeah. Also, a lesson that you should brush up on basic geography.
Yes.
Because, yeah, for listeners who have not watched the movie, it's going to spoil the movie. But, yeah, they, like, win this trip by a radio station thing because they say that, God, what do they say the capital of Brazil is? But it's wrong.
And now I'm trying, like, what is it? It's Rio,
it's Brasilia.
Right? Oh, so it's not Rio. So they probably said Rio.
Yeah, I think they said Rio.
Yeah. Well done. Good. I've learned something. I
learned that from that movie.
It's educational.
But yeah, just that they get to this resort and it's like closed. It's like the off season. Like there's like so many red flags like immediately and they're like, oh, totally fine. But then I'm sorry, that villain reveal kills me every time.
So funny. It just was so tidy, wasn't it? Like, it's not a love triangle. Get back together with the guy from the first movie. Cause I'm evil. That movie reminded me of, like, do you remember, this may be me being old, but the, like, super specials, like, Babysitter's Club would have these, like, chiller, like, double issues where they would go, like, they would go someplace, and for some reason they would all travel together, which is really unrealistic. Like, what parent would take the entire Babysitter's Club on vacation? But that's what it reminded me of. It was like, let's do this movie, but, like, super special. We'll take them on vacation somewhere.
I do remember those. And I was like, are they all getting just like, what is the budget for these parents to take like a whole group of babysitters plus their children, like plus their family?
I know.
Like, and worry about logistics and transportation. And that's true.
But then they would have these things happen to them, like they'd be in a haunted hotel and then they'd go home and it would be like it never happened. They'd never talk about it again. It's very dreamlike.
Yeah.
Because they're a lot into the Babysitter's Club right now.
Trent and Amber. Do you listen to the Babysitter's Club podcast?
No. No.
They don't do Babysitter's Club stuff anymore because they did all the books.
Wow.
But it's essentially like two middle-aged guys reading the Babysitter's Club books. And one of them had a nostalgia for it. Like, you know, went to like his cousin's house and would read them off her shelf. And so he's like walking his friend through it. But you know, you get to a certain point where like these girls never age. They're like perpetually seventh grade. And you know, they found interviews with Anna Martin talking about how she essentially wanted to trap these girls in amber, I believe was her wording. And so they like talked about it like a horror thing, and they have all these like weird spin-off like cosmic horror theories about the Babysitter's Club universe.
Whoa. Yeah, that's pretty freaky. like this sort of Truman Show aspect of sort of like being trapped and observed, but like what if they stuck, they made Truman stay at age 11 or whatever.
Yeah.
And if their minds progressed past that, but their bodies didn't, that would be very troubling.
That would be.
That's cool. I like that. It's funny. I wonder if it was because of the super specials, but I did go straight from Babysitter's Club to Christopher Pike. There was nothing in between. Well, there was like, I read a lot of like true ghost stories. I was pretty obsessed with ghosts as a kid, which will surprise no one now that I am a horror author. But yeah, it seemed to track like Babysitter's Club because of the super specials. I could now read things about like slashers tormenting teenagers.
I mean, it seems like a good pipeline.
Yeah.
Well, should we talk about some books?
Yeah.
My first pick is probably the expected pick. But yes, I am talking about The Ruins by Scott Smith, because I just feel like if you talk about vacation horror, you talk about Americans abroad, I just feel like The Ruins is what people are going to think of when it comes to like proper horror properties.
Mm-hmm.
So this is about two young couples who are on a lazy Mexican vacation, and they make friends with fellow tourists, and the brother of one of those tourists disappears, and he essentially recruits them all on this trip to go to these ruins where his brother was last seen. As they are like making their way there, you know, their driver doesn't want to go there and is telling them like, nope, you should definitely not go over there. But, you know, they're like, we'll pay you more. Okay, fine. We'll take you there. And they go there and find that they are immediately stranded on these ruins, and they are essentially like not allowed to leave. And this group immediately starts turning against each other. You know, they figure out essentially what happened to the people that were there before. Things escalate, tensions rise with the people, and it is bloody and psychological.
You've done a really good job of describing that book without spoilers, so I will try to as well, because it's hard.
It is hard.
But I went into that book like blank, so I think it is good to recommend the book that way, because yeah, what the horror is very interesting. But yeah, I mean, this is another scenario in a book where I can sort of see myself in it, that I would be the person that was like, I don't want to just stay on a beach all day. I want to go and see ancient ruins and go for a hike and see nature. And I would feel really kind of good about myself in doing that. Like, I was not being an ugly American. I was actually going out and experiencing the culture in some way that is in morally or intellectually better than the people around me who were just getting drunk by the pool. I guess the real first sin, and there's a lot of sins in this book and ways that people are horrible to each other and make crucial mistakes. But the first one is not listening to the warning signs. If somebody from the area says you need to not do this, you need to not go there, you listen. You don't go, oh, yeah, but you know what? Like, ruins are really cool and I want to see it. And I can justify that because this guy's looking for his brother.
Yeah.
But I could see myself doing that, honestly.
It's funny because I have always identified with the Jenna Malone character. Of course, now I'm forgetting her name in the book. But the one that...
I've seen the movie. Is it good?
It's pretty good. It's different from the book. Which is a...
I didn't know Jenna Malone was in it. I love her.
Yeah. Which is a little bit of a gripe I have, because in the book, her character, I think, is a little more competent, and they give a lot of her positive traits to her boyfriend, Jeff, who's like the leader of the group. And so they just kind of make her out to be this like drag on the group, and makes her like a very hateable character. Everyone in the story is like a hateable character to some extent. There is no like, there is no hero ever, especially like when, you know, day whatever, things start getting worse and the psychological horror of it ramps up and they like really start turning on each other. You know, like, no one is coming out good.
They're easily manipulated. I mean, it is this kind of like couples vacation again, like turned up to 11 by circumstances. Like, all this stuff was going on in the background anyway. You know, this is how they felt about each other privately and
yeah.
little microaggressions, but yeah, this is a hard book to talk about. I'm just going to say that. What circumstances conspire to bring all that sort of inner life outward. And yeah, it's a very depressing book. Very kind of bleak.
It is.
In the sense that it's just going to keep happening too is, it's hard to not sort of take away from that the author just thinks maybe humanity is just kind of a lost cause.
Well, the ending to the movie is different.
Oh, really?
But I'm like, that's still bleak in a way.
Yeah, but the book keeps it kind of personal, that it isn't, you don't have to think about the greater implications of things. It's like, well, these people just kind of, they were going to tear into each other at some point anyway.
Yeah. This circumstance just really helped bring all issues to the surface. It was like therapy, really, like really intense couples therapy.
It just does remind me of that second season of White Lotus, actually, those two couples. And have you seen that show?
I watched the first season. I didn't watch the I didn't watch the second season.
That's in Italy. It's quite good.
I'll have to check it out. I did hear that it was good. Okay, I would put The Ruins in the freezer. There are scenes of body horror described in this book that still haunt me to this day. Stuff from the circumstances, but then also, like, Jeff is a med student and he has to do, like, this very primitive, like, surgical, like, medical stuff and amputation. Like, it is just, like, rough. Like, these people have it rough up there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's upsetting for sure. And I think the bleakness adds to it. There's not a lot of kind of comic relief moments to diffuse it, which is something that I have to do in my books so that I can get through writing them. So I admire that sort of bleakness, even though I sort of kind of, it makes me like a book less, honestly.
If it's bleak.
When there's the dark ending. Because I just, there's some part of me that needs a little like pat on the back at the end of something, even horror.
Yeah, I kind of get that. I don't think I tend to gravitate towards like really bleak endings. It's like I look back and I'm like, I get why it was done, but it's not my favorite for sure.
Sometimes it's great though. Sometimes yeah. the bad I'm ending like, is the most satisfying. Like Drag Me to Hell, I always cite as like at the end of that movie. I mean, the movie's called Drag Me to Hell. If it hadn't had a sad ending, you'd be disappointed.
That's true. So that is The Ruins by Scott Smith.
All right, I got one, and it goes with this one, actually. I'm going to recommend The Ritual by Adam Neville, which is about a bunch of, I'm going to say young middle-aged, like they're like 34. They were college roommates, four guys from England, who've kind of drifted apart, and they're taking a reunion trip to bond again. And they've gone hiking in Sweden again, something that I would totally sign up for. But two of them are not really prepared for the hike and are already injured. So the very capable kind of leader of the group, the glue, who keeps them, their friendships going really, decides that they should just take a quick detour through these woods so that they can cut off the hike and get to where they're going sooner, which is the fatal mistake because these woods are every kind of wrong. I'm still not sure if it is like a parallel dimension, like kind of pocket universe thing, but there's a monster in there and it just goes really badly. And the tensions between them come to a boil. And they get really lost, which I find that really scary. Yeah. So you get the survival horror aspect of it. I mean, it's really visceral, the descriptions of their, like, just starting from their wet clothes and the injuries and having to sort of keep hobbling through despite, you know, a twisted knee or like a sort of a rash from the wetness. And it's just raining solidly the whole time they're there. And they come across this cabin. So of course they go in, they want to get out of the rain, they want to light the thing. And the cabin is the, I think it's that's actually the second big red flag. The first is that they find this like moose hanging from a branch, like laid out nicely, but gutted. And they're like, whoa, that's weird. I didn't know a bear could, you know, put a moose in a tree. And that's how they justify it to themselves, because that's what you would do.
Yeah.
And it just gets more and more horrible for them as it goes on. So the first half is kind of this survival aspect with lots of weird stuff in this in the woods. And then at about the halfway mark, it takes an even stranger turn. And they encounter some local Swedish people. Now, I don't know anything about Sweden, so I can't say that this is like an authentic depiction of Swedish culture, and I would hope that it is not. But it definitely gets into the more sort of, whereas the first half is, they could be in any wilderness, really, European kind of specifically from some of the sacrificial sort of signs that they find. But the second half is very much, oh yeah, they are in Sweden. It's an interesting book. It's almost two books. And so in terms of the fear factor, I don't really get scared by books that much, but the first half of the book was really scary. And then the second half was so strange that it, to me, was less scary. So I think it averages out to Fridge. But there were moments in the first half that were very moving. Like, it deals with this friendship group and their injuries and losing each other and the danger that they're in really humanely. And I found it really moving, actually. And then the second half is somebody having to really grapple with the mistakes that they've made over their lives. And yeah, like there's a death metal band. There's these like kids from a death metal band that show up. It's very bonkers.
I saw the movie. I did really like the movie.
Mm-hmm.
So is it fairly close?
It is. I think the sort of the beats were in different places in the movie versus the book. I can't really remember. Is it at like the halfway mark that he gets sort of tended to by the old woman?
I think so. Are they going on the trip to like in remembrance of their friend that died?
Yes, but you don't find that out in the book until like way later.
Okay. And it's not. Yeah, that's like right at the beginning of the movie.
It's much more like we're middle-aged and we're going through divorces and everything kind of sucks and we need to hang out again and try to remember how to be friends, and they're not good at it.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Yeah. It speaks to, you know, that this particular difficulty that middle-aged men have. I don't know if it's just British men or it's universal of like maintaining friendships from their youth.
Yeah.
And making new friends even, you know, whereas I think women find it easier to keep those relationships going. Men really struggle with it. And that becomes the tension of the group is the, you know, we used to be close and now we're not.
That's interesting.
There's usually like a sort of relationship tension point or boiling point in these, aren't there? Like mm-hmm. the ruins, yeah. It's the dysfunctional romantic relationships. And in this case, it's a sort of dysfunctional friend group. The Ritual by Adam Neville.
I need to pick that up. I really enjoyed the movie. That's been on my TBR for like ever.
It's really, yeah, it's interesting. It's the depictions of the sort of perils of nature and the discomforts of the survival mm-hmm. elements of it are really visceral and affecting.
Speaking of more like relationship stuff, my next pick is Candy Cane Kills by Brian McCauley. And it's funny because most of these vacation stories are like summer stories, like summer vacation. And this is like, no, for Christmas, we're renting an Airbnb. It's like winter vacation. So this is about Austin, whose parents are on the brink of divorce. And this is like their last attempt of like doing something for the families. Like, we're going to, you know, we're in LA, we're gonna rent a cabin up in Big Bear for Christmas and just have like, you know, a really magical Christmas in this like snowy town. But what they don't know is that there is bloody history behind that cabin, of course. And yeah, when things just start going wrong. And it is interesting to see the relationships and how they got strengthened, honestly, through this, like, having to work together against this, like, common enemy and common evil. And this was just such a fun book. Like, it was, like, a fun, like, Christmas slasher novella.
So, Candy Cane is the killer, or?
Yeah, Candy Cane, like, C-A-I-N.
And that's really her name?
Yeah, Candy Cane.
I don't know this book. I love it already. That is hilarious.
And there's going to be a sequel, which I'm excited about. As, you know, in slasher nature.
You have to have a franchise. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and this is through Shockwave Books, and kind of like their aesthetic is like old VHS type thing. So it's just in that genre. It's a lot of fun.
Even that setup of the, like, the parents are going to get a divorce and, like, how much that affects the kids. Like, that's such an 80s kind of horror movie setup. Like, oh, family's going to be torn apart. And now we're going to be torn apart by knives.
Yep. That should have been the
tagline.
Yeah, that should have been the tagline.
Always do a mock-up poster. There you go.
I would put this is between room temperature and fridge. I will say, like, there was some pretty, like, gruesome kills, but the tone of this overall is kind of fun.
Yeah. I like that. I think there's room in my heart for, like, deep introspective horror that really speaks to the human condition and is the kind of horror where, you know, it's really about something else. But then there's room in my heart, a lot of room in my heart, for things that just deliver on the premise. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That are like snakes, like what Snakes on a Plane should have been. Like the trailer for Snakes on a Plane, like as a book, you know, that it just does what it says on the box and it just delivers the promise of the premise. So I've got a recommendation along those lines, which I really, really like. It's called Adrift by K.R. Griffiths. And so this is vampires on a cruise ship.
I love that.
And it's the way it's written is very much like one of those kind of British terrorist thrillers where you're like, you get the terrorist perspective and you get the beat cop and you get, you know, the world weary. I mean, this is not what you get in this book. I'm just giving an analogy. So in this, you get the people that are in league with the vampires. And then you get the head of security who was ex-military. And you get the poor guy that has agoraphobia and is on honeymoon with his wife. And this is like really brave thing for him to do, because he has severe PTSD from a random attack, robbery. But he's done it for his wife, who he adores, and they're going on the biggest cruise ship in the world on its maiden voyage across the Atlantic. And, like, man, he doesn't even get to enjoy the ship. It's hours in, an EMP goes off, and the ship is just plunged into darkness. Because if you think about a cruise ship, you think of it being well lit. But if all the lights are off, there's so many interior corridors and things, and they're in complete darkness on this massive ship. And then a big crate full of vampires is dropped into the middle of it. And now these are not like a huge shipping container, and it crushes people when it falls.
I'm obsessed with this. Sorry, keep going.
It's so good. So, I mean, you know, some books, when the monster comes, you're like, oh God, oh no, the monster's coming. And in this, you're like, the monsters are coming. This is awesome. You're gonna kill everybody. It's just so, I mean, and I feel bad because there are these really affecting moments of like people dying horribly. So I have to, you know, take account of the fact that I was so gleefully reading it, but it is just fun. So for example, you have like the scene of absolute carnage, you know, told very viscerally in a very, very frightening way. And then it cuts to another POV immediately. And it's this guy going, vampires? Are you fucking kidding me? Like, what? And it's great because it like cuts the tension. I mean, all the sort of beats are there of just a really, really fun read. And I also appreciate the, as much as I love the kind of analogy of vampires as the rich, the elite, that are sort of elegant and seductive and suck you dry. I don't find that scary. But these are like primordial inhuman beasts that will just rip out the organ in you that will keep you alive and suffering and then watch. You know, they're like really scary. So I found, and the element of being in the total dark in an enclosed space where there's all kinds of hazards, you know, like in a cruise ship, and it's fun. It's like, we might fall in the indoor pool because you don't see it, or you might fall down the steps and get a concussion and then there's the monster. It's just a really, really fun book. So that's the, I did want to also shout out Whiteout by Gabriel Dillon, who's a friend of mine. He wrote another YA, vacation book where they're in a ski resort that gets overrun with vampires. And again, it's like not the elegant Anne Rice vampires. They are really, really scary. They're like cave dwellers most of the time. So that's the kind of vampires I like. So this is Adrift by K.R. Griffiths, by far my favorite cruise ship horror I've ever read. I'm gonna say it's a fridge, just because it's so much fun. You know, like there are bits of it that are really scary, like you get your heart racing, but it's just so enjoyable that you don't really get fully scared. Although, I mean, nothing scares me, so.
It sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, I loved it.
My final pick is Narcissus by Adam Godfrey. This is a novella, and it is following a group of Americans vacationing in Greece, and they set out to find a subterranean pool that's rumored to be the one by which the demigod Narcissus once wasted away in self-obsession. And what started out as a fun excursion quickly escalates to a full-blown nightmare, because after they look in the pool, they come to find that their own reflections are infected by an ancient evil. After looking in this pool, anytime they catch their own reflection, like something is off about it, and it gets this curse that they now all have, where they have to avoid their reflection because their reflection is off and it will like drive them insane. And there's also something like coming after them via their reflection.
Oh, I love that. That's scary. That's a scary idea.
It is really scary. And it's so inventive in that, you know, they're like, oh, I simply just won't look in mirrors. Like, I will cover up the mirrors. But like, your reflection is in a lot more than just
any reflection surface.
Yeah.
Like a shiny table.
Yeah. It's very much like Smile. Like if you watch the horror movie Smile, it's like, yeah, they all have this thing that's like coming for them. And you're also following this cop who's like coming across these like very awful bodies, because the kills in this also like do not hold back. Like they're like awful kills. And you also see like what they see, but like what they see is being manipulated by this like curse.
Wow.
As they're dying. It was very good, and very good for a novella where like it's all like sustained in a very short amount of pages.
Are they warned? Like, are when they're in Greece, are people like, don't go there?
Yeah, like when they go in, they're like, oh, you know, they say that these waters, like looking in there will drive you crazy or something like
not,
that.
Not necessarily. I'll murder you. I love that tie to Greek mythology too. And I love the sort of like, I don't know, there's a certain consumerist aspect to tourism of like, I get to do whatever I want. I'm going to see all the sights and like check off my bucket list. And it's like in doing that, that you have committed a crime of not taking the culture seriously enough or the mythology seriously enough. And that's sort of the initial sin.
Yeah. They also like find a survivor, like another person who like had the curse and is like living. So it's kind of like Final Destination 2, where like they find Clear and she's like survived the first movie, but she's like not living her fullest life, you know, because she is like haunted by this curse. It has a little bit of that as well.
Yeah. Is it like in the first Batman movie where like everyone starts to look really bad because they can't use makeup? They always have something in their teeth. That sounds great. I'm going to check that one out.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with it. I would put this, I would put this in the fridge. There was some really good, like, inventive kills that I was not expecting. Like, and it's got that, like, something's always lurking.
I like creepy Greek mythology. That's fun. That's different from, like, you know, Circe and all the in the Greek mythology retellings. I like that this one is actually just, like, a serial killer.
It's like a slasher curse.
Well, I actually have a weird connection, but my last recommendation has another kind of sort of evil Greek mythology aspect to it.
Ooh.
So this is a collection of short stories. It's Don't Look Now and Other Stories is the, there's a lot of different compilations of Daphne du Maurier short stories, but this is a particularly good one. So Don't Look Now, I think a lot of people know, and I will talk about that. But the one that has the Greek mythology connection is called Not After Midnight. And it's this very British school teacher who's been sort of sent off on sabbatical to sort of do research in Greece. So he's gone off to this Greek resort and he meets this really weird American couple that are kind of obnoxious and loud. And it winds up being a sort of ambiguous as to whether he is actually cursed or whether he's just using that as an excuse for his own alcoholism by this like statue of Bacchus that they leave for him. But it's so creepy and sort of creeping, this sense of this leering object and this way his peace of mind is just infiltrated by it. It's very much psychological horror, as most of Daphne du Maurier is, but that's a good one in the collection. So that's, you know, somebody traveling to, I mean, they're all very, very British. They're all very Brits abroad, which is like the British equivalent of ugly Americans. But I Don't Look Now, which everybody knows from the movie mostly because of like, everybody knows the ending. Everybody knows like this, the sex scene with Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie. It was like so realistic. They thought it was actually porn. The short story is different. It's extremely British in the way that most of it deals with this man who he went on vacation in Venice with his wife. They're mourning the death of their child, but that's kind of incidental. And she has to go. There's an emergency at home and she has to go. But this is before the time of like being able to connect via cell phone or email or anything. So he gets this sort of sense that something has gone really wrong with her, that she has not made it home, that something horrible has happened to her. And he goes to the police, he goes everywhere. And it's just like the series of kind of missed connections and misunderstandings. And then the ending, which I am going to give away because I think everybody knows it. He follows this sort of red coat that reminds him of his child. And it turns out to be this serial killer that's kind of mentioned throughout the story. That's a little person, is a dwarf. But what's so funny about it is in the end, he's like, oh, you know, figures. He's not in the movie. It's really, really scary. And in the story, he's like, well, yeah, this would happen to me, wouldn't it? Like, like, all right, well, serves me right. Kind of, he sort of dies thinking like, well, I'm an idiot. And I just loved that. It was so British, you know, like Sod's Law. Oh, well. Don't have to go to the police anymore. And then the other short story has to do with travel, and that is called The Way of the Cross. And it's about this guy going on like a church trip to Jerusalem. And it's really important to him to see all these religious sites. And there's so much dread in this story and so much tension. And he has so many resentments towards his fellow travelers. And he just judges them all so harshly for not appreciating the place in the right way. And you kind of think it's heading in the direction of like Midnight Mass. It feels like something horrible is going to happen to this man, that it's just cascading into a horrible thing happening to him. And a horrible thing does happen to him, but it is not at all what you expect. Daphne du Maurier is the master of introducing what you think is the threat, and then it's something else completely. And every one of the stories in this has that element of it, of you think that this is the horror, well, it's something else. And I won't spoil that one, but it's quite poignant and fitting for this character. And I would not say that these are really much more psychological horror. I would say it's room temperature, but they stay with you for a long time. I think about those stories a lot. And the travel aspect as well. Explored from different angles. She was clearly preoccupied with British people going to places where they didn't belong and what could go wrong under those circumstances.
I'll have to check this out. I actually just bought it on the Kindle store the other day because it was on sale. So I'll have to check it out. Yeah. I don't know what my table of contents is because you said they're all like pretty different.
Yeah, it should. Sometimes if it's the one with the birds, it's a different one.
It's Don't Look Now, Not After Midnight, Borderline Case, Way of the Cross, and The Breakthrough.
Borderline Case is the one where she goes to Ireland because she realized her dad had this connection to IRA terrorists, and she like wants to write an article about them. And that's another one where, yeah, something awful is going to happen, and it's not what you think. It's like okay. All of these are. And funnily enough, the breakthrough one seems like it's going to be really, really horrific, and it's actually kind of sweet and thoughtful and introspective.
Oh. You've made me excited to check this out.
I love her. I mean, she's like my sort of hallmark.
Well, a tradition we have on this podcast is to ask our guests for a chilling obsession or something that they've been enjoying in horror lately.
All right, mine is another book, and I got to blurb it, and I'm really excited about it. It comes out this fall. It's called The Black Hunger by Nicholas Pullen, and it is just the most genre-defying book, and those are my favorite kinds of books, but this is like a historical adventure. It's one of these books that has like a story within a story within a story because there's a, you know, a journal that's found and then a letter that's read within it, so it's like a puzzle box. And it's just so bonkers. It's about Buddhist cannibal cults that are trying to bring about the end of the world. And I don't want to give too much away about it because it is just the most delightfully terrifying and romantic and sweeping book. I mean, it takes you all across the globe, and into Oxford. And I think it's set in like, oh gosh, is it? I think it's pre-World War I, but there's like, you know, spy agencies. There's just everything I would want in a book is in this book. And the monsters are really, really scary. And the baddies are really scary. And the cannibalism is icky, but not to the extent that you're like, I have to put this away. And it's the first in a series, which I'm very excited about. And I'm going to be obnoxious to this poor writer because he asked me to blurb it, which was very kind of him. I'm going to be like, I need to see the sequel as soon as you've written it. Because I'm talking about this book.
I mean, that's high praise. That sounds really interesting.
It's just like delicious. It's like a candy box of horror. You know, it's got like everything. Without it, it holds together, but it has all these elements of like fun horror, you know, sort of like Russian count, like in a remote estate that mistreats his servants. And
yeah.
And to have like Buddhists be the baddies is really interesting.
I don't think I've come across that before.
Yeah, it's great.
What was that title again?
The Black Hunger by Nicholas Pullen. And I think it comes out in September.
Okay. I'll have to keep my eye out for that. Well, the second tradition we have on this podcast is to ask our guests for a final girl song. So what is your song?
So I think a lot of songs would be kind of like sort of defiant, but defeated and like sort of gritty. And mine is not that. My final girl song would be Mr. Blue Sky by Electric Light Orchestra, which is the most like defiantly, almost like aggressively, angrily cheerful song I have ever heard. It's so relentlessly like fuck you happy. That would be it. It would be, you know, I'm not only going to walk out of this scenario alive, But fuck you. I am happy and I'm going to be happy. I'm going to be like a Disney freaking princess the rest of my life just to in defiance. And I guess that's what the song's about. It's like, and if you've ever lived in England, you know that like we get really angry at the gray sky around this time of year. And when the sun comes out, we're like, yeah, screw you, English weather. Like, and that's why the song is so kind of angrily happy. And that's what I would be. I'd be like, no, I'm going to thrive now. I'm walking away and I'm just going to be so happy for the rest of my life. And I hate you. That would be my thing also.
I love that. I'm loving this energy.
Angrily upbeat. Yeah. And that's kind of my personality, actually.
Like upbeat out of spite.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thank you so much for coming on here and talking with me today about Diavola and vacation horror.
Thank you. This is so fun.
Where can people find you online?
I have a website that I do update from time to time, jenniferthorne.com. I am on Instagram as, I think it's Jen Marie Thorne. I'm on TikTok every once in a while when I can be bothered, and I'm on Threads. And I think that about wraps it up. Yeah. Instagram's probably the best way to find me.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Books in the Freezer is a bi-weekly podcast. We post episodes every other Tuesday. You can find us on TikTok, Threads, and Instagram at Books in the Freezer, or you can send us an email at booksinthefreezer@gmail.com. Show notes for this episode and all previous episodes are at booksinthefreezer.com, where you will find a list of the books mentioned, as well as several different ways you can support the podcast, including links to the Patreon, links to merch, and affiliate links. So again, that is booksinthefreezer.com. And it is not too late to participate in this year's reading challenge. You can find that on Instagram under hashtag BITF Reading Challenge 24. You can also find links on the show notes, which I believe take you to the official reading challenge on StoryGraph. And if you're a StoryGraph user, you can use it as a reading challenge and mark off books as you go and, you know, specify what prompt you would like to use this book for. It's a lot of fun. It's a great platform. I have been your host, Stephanie Gagne, and thank you so much for listening. See you next time on Books in the Freezer.